Even before the meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un in Hanoi, foreign policy practitioners and observers were talking about the difficulties associated with sequencing international sanctions relief for North Korea's denuclearization and disarmament. Sure enough, North Korea demands more sanctions relief while Washington wants more disarmament. What is the right way forward? Our guest today believes that the American approach to negotiations with North Korea has been too inflexible. Pointedly, he calls out the fact that maximum pressure campaign launched against Pyongyang is meaningless if it does not translate to outcomes at the negotiating table. It's a timely discussion with very specific policy recommendations that you don't see very often discussed. It was a very thought-provoking discussion, so without further delay, from the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., I'm Yong Kwon, and this is Korean Context. Daniel Wirtz is the program manager at the National Committee on North Korea, a non-governmental organization dedicated to fostering mutual understanding and trust between the governments and peoples of the United States and North Korea. He's here today as a contributor to the On Korea Journal for KAEI. Dan, thanks for being on Korean Context with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're the inaugural author of KAEI's academic paper series for 2019. I think the main crux of your paper can be summed up as sanctions alone are not a substitute for diplomatic strategy. I think that's a good, perhaps a thesis statement for your paper. Let's start with perhaps the most recent significant development. From what we know, from what you know, how would you characterize the positions that each side approached the summit in Hanoi?
So in the months before the summit and the month after the summit, the U.S. position on sanctions has been that sanctions won't be lifted until North Korea is denuclearized. There seemed to be a little bit of flexibility in the U.S. statements about sanctions relief immediately prior to the Hanoi summit. Steve Biegun, the special envoy for North Korea, gave a speech at Stanford where he indicated a U.S. willingness to engage in a kind of step-by-step approach. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, talking to NBC News, said that, you know, sanctions won't be start to be lifted until the threat of North Korea's nuclear program is substantially reduced. That's a very different bar. But after Hanoi, the kind of U.S. line was status quo ante. For the North Koreans' part, they have vehemently denounced in their typical way the U.S. denuclearization first approach, have called for a step-by-step approach to negotiations and corresponding actions from the U.S. in return for their own actions on their nuclear program. At Hanoi, according to the press statement from North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho, issued after the summit ended without any agreement, he said that the North Koreans had offered to dismantle part or all of the Yongbyon nuclear facility in exchange for the lifting of the five most recent UN Security Council resolutions sanctioning North Korea. And these are by far the most important sanctions resolutions. They target almost all of North Korea's commercial exports, many of North Korea's key imports. They impose very strict financial restrictions on Pyongyang, shipping restrictions, require the repatriation of North Korean overseas workers. So this is a lot they were asking for. Ultimately, it was too much for the U.S. I think it remains to be seen whether or not that was a kind of opening bid on the part of the North Koreans in negotiations or whether it was their final offer. And we also have to see whether the U.S., if working-level negotiations resume, will be willing to change its position a bit and support a strategy which incorporates incremental sanctions relief. And if both sides are willing to negotiate over sanctions relief, I think that there's a lot of flexibility and there's a real chance of making progress on North Korea's nuclear program.
Principally speaking, though, it seems like, at least based on what Steve Biegun and Mike Pompeo was signaling ahead of the summit in Hanoi, there seems to have been some degree of willingness, as you mentioned, for the United States to engage in some partial sanctions relief. What do you see as the main impasse in at least the U.S. approach to North Korea?
Well, there have been a couple competing narratives about why exactly the summit came to such an abrupt end. I'm still having a hard time sorting out, one kind of narrative of the summit from another. As far as I can best tell, Kim Jong-un, in his meeting with Donald Trump, put this offer of sanctions relief for Yongbyon at the table. It had earlier been rejected at the working level in U.S.-North Korea negotiations. And the U.S. responded with a counteroffer of basically North Korea totally denuclearizes and the U.S. will lift everything. And that was a non-starter for North Korea. And seems like that's what led to the end of the summit. Not clear to me whether or not there was a real back and forth negotiating process so much as, one side putting in its offer, the other side counteroffering, and then both sides going home.
Of course, your paper argues that the most constructive, the most realistic way forward is for partial sanctions relief being offered from the United States in exchange for first confidence-building measures from North Korea, then transformative engagement from North Korea, which will eventually pave the way towards full denuclearization. However, if I may take the devil's advocate side, I think a lot of officials in the U.S. government might argue that the maximalist position that the United States government has taken, the idea that there will be no sanctions relief until North Korea denuclearizes first, plus the international sanctions regime that has been imposed on North Korea, has allowed us to get to this point where North Korea is at the table, and also to a point where North Korea has not tested nuclear weapons, nor have they tested ballistic missiles. So they might argue that so far it seems like the maximum pressure campaign without partial sanctions relief is working. How might you respond to this?
Well, I think, first of all, there's a number of reasons that are plausible for why North Korea came to the negotiating table last year. I think maximum pressure from sanctions is one of those reasons, but not the entirety. North Korea also seemed to be responding to outreach from South Korea and responding to the opportunity that presented. North Korea, it seems, may have made as much progress as they wanted to make in their burst of nuclear and missile testing in 2016 through 2017. And, as the U.S. has kept to this maximalist position since negotiations have begun, we really don't have too much to show for it. I mean, both sides have engaged in confidence-building measures. North Korea hasn't conducted further tests. They blew up their nuclear test site. But we don't have nuclear inspectors back on the ground. North Korea is still producing fissile material. It's still producing, presumably, more ballistic missiles and other WMD. So I think that if the U.S. just kind of, sticks to a maximalist position, isn't willing to compromise on sanctions, maybe down the road that will lead to more of an acute economic crisis in North Korea. But I think it's pretty clear, based on North Korea's history, that even if things get bad there, the regime is certainly capable of withstanding pain, or more precisely, deflecting pain to its population. And I think it's very unlikely that North Korea will capitulate in response to unrelenting U.S. demands. I think there's also another risk that if negotiations fail and North Korea is able to blame U.S. obstinacy as the reason for that failure, there's a significant risk that the sanctions regime after that point will really start to fall apart, that China and Russia will be significantly less interested in enforcing the sanctions that they've signed up to, and there's already significant questions about slippage in their implementation. It could create real crisis in U.S.-South Korea relations. Could lead to potentially a lot of strife in the U.S.-China relationship if the U.S. starts to implement sanctions against major Chinese banks that do business with North Korea, as some sanctions advocates have called for. So if Kim Jong-un ends up in a situation where negotiations have failed, his economy is not doing very well, but the U.S. is alienated from every other important stakeholder in the region other than Japan, it's not necessarily the worst outcome for him.
I think that's very important to take into consideration. I think you're outlining how there are limitations, there are constraints to even the maximum part of maximum pressure. There's only so far that the United States can really push North Korea before the region pushes back on the U.S. demands for cooperation on this matter. You also mention in your paper very clearly and very importantly that what's perhaps missing in the U.S. approach is that it's not sufficiently addressing two key components of implementing a sanctions regime. One is communicating a clear terms of relief, and two, incorporation of realistic set of goals and other ways to shape the target's political calculus and interests. How would you rate the way the U.S. has communicated the terms of sanctions relief to North Korea, and where could it improve?
I mean, the U.S., as you've mentioned, it's taken a maximalist position on sanctions relief, which is to say North Korea has to abandon the entirety of its WMD programs as a first step. That is, you know, also what's articulated in the UN Security Council resolutions on North Korea, that North Korea must completely, verifiably, irreversibly abandon its WMD programs. But the Security Council resolutions also say in each resolution that sanctions may be strengthened, adjusted, or changed in accordance to North Korean compliance or noncompliance. So there is a mechanism, I think, implicitly built in the UN Security Council resolutions that they can be pared back in return for at least partial North Korean compliance. And I think for the U.S. and other Security Council countries to articulate what North Korea would have to do to get partial sanctions relief, that could really help actually achieve the first real tangible steps in this negotiation process and get North Korea to at least partially start rolling back its nuclear and ballistic missile programs.
One thing that I was curious about is you mentioned that there are also other means that should be applied to engage with North Korea alongside sanctions relief. What did you mean by that? Could you expand on what you meant by other ways?
Yeah, so sanctions, they're just one tool in the policy toolbox. They've got to be used in conjunction with other tools of diplomacy, inducements, deterrence, etc. Ultimately, for sanctions to be effective, North Korea has to make the calculus that maintaining its WMD programs is no longer in its best interest. And we want to change that calculus. Offering sanctions relief in part or entirety is an important way to change that calculus. But there's also a lot of other tools we can have to change North Korea's calculus, everything from confidence-building measures, addressing conventional security threats on the Korean Peninsula, changing the U.S.-North Korea relationship more broadly. I think these all go hand in hand in some ways. It's not – you can't just separate sanctions relief and North Korean concessions on its nuclear program from a broader process of how North Korea is changing its relations with the United States, with South Korea, with the rest of the world. And I think especially if we're going to try to go all the way to full North Korean denuclearization, you know, the only way I see that happening is if it's part of a much broader strategic decision on the part of the North Korean leadership to change their security strategy, to change their relations with the rest of the world, and to a limited extent, to change their domestic political system.
I have a question on that, actually, because it seems like a lot of the concerns facing U.S. policymakers is that there is too much risk involved with approaching North Korea, because it's really a chicken and egg kind of situation where in order for North Korea to fully denuclearize, we need to see signs of North Korea's willingness to open up to the rest of the world, integrate with the global economy. But they can't really do that until the U.S. also takes steps to perhaps open up a little bit and to provide for North Korea the means and the vehicles to engage with the rest of the world. But because this needs to take place before North Korea signals willingness to change domestically, there seems to be a sequencing issue where the United States cannot commit to taking that first step because there are no reassurances to there being denuclearization at the end of the line. How would you recommend the United States government reassess this risk?
The first order of business in negotiations would have to be stopping North Korea's fissile material production, its production of ballistic missiles. I think once we get to that point where the North Korean nuclear problem is not actively getting worse with every day, where all the centrifuges are still spinning while they're producing more and better missiles, you know, once we get to that point, there is, I think, a lot more flexibility in how we engage. And I would argue that as UN, US sanctions, and inter-Korean sanctions are lifted, we should try to lift those sanctions in a way that facilitates what I would call transformative engagement within North Korea, that really tests whether North Korea is willing to engage with the rest of the world on a very different basis than how it hitherto has. For example, I think that if the Kaesong Industrial Complex is to reopen, it should be conditioned on a major change in how that facility operates. I think, number one, the North Korean workers there should be paid their wages directly rather than their wages going to the North Korean state. I think it would also be very helpful if the South Korean managers at Kaesong had more freedom to interact with their North Korean employees. It would be great if the South Korean businesses at Kaesong could form more linkages to the rest of the North Korean economy, sourcing inputs for Kaesong from the rest of North Korea, exporting some of the goods produced at Kaesong to the rest of North Korea, really make this inter-Korean project less of an island and more of a bridge between the two Koreas. Similarly, the UN could, for example, as part of a negotiating process leading to North Korea's ultimate denuclearization, approve new investments in North Korea on a case-by-case basis, so long as those investments meet certain criteria that they, you know, meet International Labor Organization standards, that they contribute to the general welfare of the North Korean population, and of course that these investments are not in sensitive areas.
I feel that some of the policymakers in the United States who have been studying the long-term process of negotiating with North Korea might retort and say, well, we've tried this part-for-part sanctions relief in the 90s when we were trying to negotiate the agreed framework. North Korea didn't stick to their end of the bargain and it didn't work out. So what are the guarantees for it working out this time? How might you respond to statements like that?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, past incidents of U.S. partial sanctions relief for North Korea, for the most part, the sanctions that the U.S. lifted were effectively done as confidence-building measures, moving negotiations forward with North Korea. For the most part, as the U.S. has relieved sanctions in the 90s and in the late 2000s under the six-party talks, you know, that didn't provide North Korea with significant tangible economic benefit for the most part. And sanctions imposed in that period were simply not commensurate to the goals that they were, you know, set out to try to achieve. The one exception, the sanction on North Korea that really had a big impact, was the sanctions on Banco Delta Asia, this Macau-based bank, where North Korea had about $25 million in dirty money frozen after the U.S. declared the bank to be a bank of primary money laundering concern. The $25 million was returned to North Korea as part of the six-party talks that blunted the momentum of a U.S. campaign to isolate North Korea from the international financial system. But ultimately, the Banco Delta Asia sanctions, they were really poorly suited to be used as negotiating leverage. And in contrast, I think today we have a sanctions regime on North Korea that is far greater in breadth and depth. I think there are a lot of tools that we have today to give incremental sanctions relief, to have credible snapback mechanisms in place, to really play around with the measures we have and be creative in how we apply or loosen sanctions pressure that we didn't have in past rounds of negotiations with North Korea. Will that get us to the promised land of denuclearization? I don't know. But I think that if we structure an incremental sanctions relief program right, it could significantly help to roll back parts of the North Korean nuclear program, or at the very least, help to keep together the coalition imposing sanctions on North Korea if North Korea proves unwilling to stick to any deal.
I think one of the main critics of the partial sanctions relief process that you lay out in your paper maybe people from perhaps the human rights community and other communities that are looking at North Korea's crimes that go beyond denuclearization issue. So proliferation of chemical weapons, North Korea's activities in cyber crimes. And the arguments that I've seen people in this community raise is that we are in a position where we have North Korea backed into a corner. If we give North Korea partial sanctions relief now, it'll be very difficult to impose the same level of pressure on North Korea again, because, say, North Korea denuclearizes and then the United States goes back to address human rights crimes and is considering reimposing sanctions, it gives North Korea a pathway perhaps back into recidivism on the nuclear issue. So I think a lot of people are concerned that if we let go of this pressure point now, that the United States would not have the opportunity to address issues that go beyond denuclearization. How do you look into this situation?
Well, I'd look first at the statutory language behind U.S. sanctions laws as well as the language of U.N. Security Council resolutions. So the U.N. resolutions are imposed on relatively narrow grounds. They're imposed on the basis of North Korea's development of WMD. And I think if North Korea meets the criteria laid out in those sanctions resolutions of completely abandoning its WMD programs, those sanctions should be lifted. I think that's pretty straightforward. U.S. sanctions, on the other hand, especially the North Korea Sanctions and Policy Enhancement Act, which was passed in 2016, that sanctions North Korea not only on the basis of its WMD program, but also on human rights grounds, on cybersecurity grounds, for illicit activities, etc. And for sanctions to be suspended or lifted under that piece of legislation, North Korea has to make progress not only on WMD issues, but also on human rights and other issues as well. So I think that as a process of incremental sanctions relief moves forward, it's important that the U.S. be clear that some sanctions will continue to be enforced. And so long as North Korea continues to commit human rights violations, cybersecurity-related breaches, etc., those human rights and cybersecurity sanctions will remain in force. I think there is, you know, maybe a theoretical challenge we have. What if North Korea completely denuclearizes but doesn't change its human rights record, doesn't improve in any other way? Will we be able to lift U.S. sanctions? And I'm not too worried about that theoretical possibility. I think that if North Korea does decide to denuclearize, it'll be, again, as part of a broader strategic shift that will entail a change in much of its activity abroad, entail at least marginal improvements in North Korean human rights. And I think that the incremental sanctions relief process could help spur those changes along. I'm not expecting, if North Korea denuclearizes, to become Switzerland, but, you know, at least make genuine enough improvements to its human rights record and to other issues that there is a genuine basis for U.S. sanctions to be, at the very least, suspended on an ongoing basis, if not lifted.
One of the end aims here is for North Korea not only to give up its nuclear weapons, but also to have the means to integrate with the global economy, which will entail other components like respect for human rights and other aspects.
Yeah, even putting any sanctions aside, if North Korea doesn't change its human rights record, it's not going to get any investment by major international companies with reputations to uphold. They don't want to be tainted with, you know, using the North Korean prison labor. They don't want to be tainted with the association of investing in a country that has such a poor human rights record. I think that there's got to be real changes in North Korea's human rights practices, both from a practical perspective, in order to get its economy to work better, they need more transparency, more openness, and from a perspective of attracting investment as well. Kim Jong-un has clearly stated he wants economic development in North Korea. He wants the North Korean people to live as well as others, as he put it last year. You know, the question is North Korea willing to take the steps that would be necessary to transform its economy, to embark on a course of economic development, if that means loosening its control over the population? And it's unclear to me how far they're willing to go on that front. I think Kim Jong-un has proven to be more tolerant of markets and market mechanisms than his father or grandfather. Perhaps if there's progress in negotiations with the U.S., that will facilitate relatively greater economic openness in North Korea. But where North Korea will ultimately draw the line, how comfortable it feels with greater economic openness, I don't know. And I think that is an important question as this process moves forward. And so far, to be frank, North Korea has been, of course, very wary of taking any economic steps that would jeopardize the system of population control in the country.
To close out, we are recording on the day before President Moon Jae-in arrives in the United States for a summit with President Trump. The United States has also announced that there might be a third summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. Date unclear, place unclear, but still a willingness has been expressed. What signals would you look for from both the North Korean side and from the U.S. side that will give you confidence that the situation is ripe for moving forward with partial sanctions relief and the strategy that you laid out in your paper?
Well, I think the most important thing is to just get the U.S. and North Korean negotiators in a room for a prolonged period to hash out the details of an agreement, which necessarily will be complicated and difficult to negotiate. It'll also be important for negotiators on both sides to be empowered by their respective leaders to come to such an agreement. I think if we have another leader-level summit without really making progress on the working level, and frankly, I don't see how that's going to move the ball forward.
That's it for the episode today. Many thanks to Daniel Wartz and to you listeners for tuning in. Please find the paper by Daniel Wartz on the Korea Economic Institute website or in the link in the description of this episode. If you liked Korean Context, I hope you will join us for our weekly newscast, Korea This Week, on Facebook every Monday at 2 p.m. Also, we have started a newsletter called Korea View, focusing on stories that South Koreans are looking at, going beyond just the North Korea nuclear issue and addressing concerns like the environment, economy, and domestic politics. Please sign up for the newsletter in the link in the description of this episode or email me directly at yk@keia.org. Please visit our website for updates on upcoming events at keia.org. See you there!